we continue the focus in terms of, you know, the child witness that might in certain instances need to testify in court, such as the case as we've seen with the 8-year-old Dross rape victim who took the stand as a witness in the case against Nicholas Nanau, who has pleaded guilty. And we've seen, you know, the NPA come through with their decision saying the child will give her testimony. That happened yesterday. We've just spoken to Not In My Name South Africa. They gave us, you know, their concerns about the trauma that might be inflicted on this child. But to help us understand and tell us a bit more in terms of the impact that a child witness has in cases of this nature and the impact that these cases have on the child as well, we are joined online by Patrick Solomon. Patrick, good morning and thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning to you and to your listeners.
Now, of course, you know, a case of this nature, very tricky, very sensitive, especially when the victim is a minor. Yesterday, we saw that minor coming through with her testimony. You know, the impact that a child witness testimony can have on a case, what have we witnessed in the past?
Well, basically, I'm like, we have made a great progress in South Africa when it comes to child witnesses in a court of law, when they have to use evidence, right? And there are many different ways in which children can provide evidence. It is very, very young children. Ordinarily, a forensic social worker, the SAS has forensic social workers. They would do it in, like, you know, to investigate the situation, and they probably would interview the child, and they would provide a kind of a victim impact statement. That is without the child actually being in court. Now, there's that one process. And then their reports, of course, would then be presented to the court. Then there is also a situation where children are presenting evidence, and this would be in camera. That means someone would interview the child, right, and then they would be, so they won't be physically in court. But they would be in another room, for example, and then that can also be admissible in court, and then the court will be able to see that. So the witness don't actually, you know, go into the court, don't even see the alleged offender. So there's also that process. Then, of course, also particularly with older kids, when it is deemed necessary, then they might ask an older child to present evidence in court. Sometimes the judge, the magistrate would then, for example, make sure that the child has sufficient protection when that happens. We often work with victims who have to give statements to the police or have to appear in court and give evidence and stuff like that. Mm. And then, of course, there's a whole process that happens beforehand. One, to prepare the child. Two, in a way that you don't interfere or change possibly any possible, evidence that the child might give, but you prepare the child so the child can be ready psychologically, to prepare the family, whoever takes care of the child for that process, for the child to know and understand what is happening, why it's happening, why it's important, for them to get an idea of if they're going to give evidence in camera, what will happen, who will be there, what is the setting might be and stuff like that. That process is very, very important because children can be easily traumatized. Mm. And therefore, ordinarily, our child legal system, for example, make provision for the protection of the child, and the child has to give evidence. And there are certain kind of guidelines for social workers, for court orderlies, for the actual court, the judges and the magistrates, right, in terms of how they should deal with children and the rights of children and the protection of children. So in this particular case, it was probably deemed necessary and important for the child to give evidence. We don't know. The child is a young child in this particular case, and therefore I assume that will happen in camera. Sure. The child, I assume, or it happened in camera, and I assume that the child would not have had any contact with the alleged offender. that the child would have been sufficiently prepared, that skilled, experienced professionals would have been assigned to the case, and that they would have taken every care to ensure that that trauma would not be inflicted on the child.
Mm.
So I assume that would have happened, and I believe because it's a high-profile case, that the professionals involved would have made every effort to make sure that the child's rights are being protected and that the child would not be traumatized.
Sure. Now, Patrick, are there instances when a child or a minor, does not want to testify? How is that then dealt with?
Yes, there's lots of cases. I mean, we work with a lot of cases. One of the big problems that we have with our justice system is that the drawn-out nature of these cases, from the time when the incident happened and from the time that the case being reported, can be a day, a week, a month, 6 months, a year, or even longer, right?
Mm.
So there's that element there. So once the case gets to court, for example, then a lot of these issues, children have to revisit their memories, revisit those trauma, and then, then they get traumatized again. And if they don't have sufficient support systems that can navigate them through that process to reduce the trauma, then they do get re-traumatized to revisit those things. They would then again, for example, younger children would start again with bedwetting, they would get nightmares, they become moody again, they become withdrawn again. You can witness that they don't function, because their schoolwork suffer, they don't communicate again so well with their families and friends and stuff like that. So that's where you get signs of the re-traumatization of the children happen.
Yes.
And then, of course, also with older children, they get tired of being prodded and probed by different people, right? With sometimes cases get moved from one court to another court, another team of social workers works in, another investigator comes on board for whatever reason, and then they get tired of it, and then particularly with older children, then they refuse to talk, they refuse to to cooperate or say anything, and they express very clearly that they're not going to court anymore. There's that kind of situation. Another situation that we do find is that, for example, something happens to the child again, right? Maybe another incident of the same nature happens again, right? We also might find that some other trauma in the family, for example, happens again, right? Or some other incident happened to the child again, and then the child refused to communicate, they refuse to cooperate with the investigating officer, or they don't want to go to court again because they had maybe a bad experience at court because the child wasn't properly supported during that process at court, or some incident happened at court. The other thing that we also find, which is a big problem, is when alleged offenders get out on bail, and then they have contact with the victim. Either they live in the same community.
Yes.
Either there's the element of fear that comes in.
Mm-hmm.
There's intimidation by the alleged offender, their families or their friends or whatever. That also has got a big issue. So the element of fear and intimidation and stuff like that, even when the alleged offender lives in another community, maybe has been removed by the court, for example, right? But their family live close by. So even seeing that those family members every day, having to go to school and pass at the house, all of those things can also bring fear in the victim and their families and stuff. So that's also a reason why cases get withdrawn, why they stop cooperating with investigating officers, with the support services that is there, or even not pitching up at court. So that's also another element there. So there's many, many different kind of scenarios that can prevent. What we found is that those victims that we support regularly, consistently, assist them, making sure that they understand what's happening, if they have any fear, whatever, approaching the courts, approaching the protection services to withdraw the bail and stuff like that, where the victim feels supported and trusts the support that's happening, coming like that they get. But in those instances, we ordinarily have a very successful conviction.
Okay. Now, Patrick, you know, when we have testimonies by witnesses, you know, that do come forward, you know, there's always that question of exactly how credible are these testimonies? What happens, you know, in the case of a child? You alluded to these cases being, you know, very long drawn. It's been a year already since the incident had taken place in terms of the Dross rape victim's case. You know, how credible is a child's testimony?
Yeah, any testimony by the court is very, very important, right? The court takes this very, very seriously. And of course, we also have a system whereby the defense can interrogate that testimony and stuff like that. So the court, based on our child justice law and our children's act, a testimony by a child must be considered very, very carefully by the court. Right, and that it carries equal weight like any other testimony given by an adult or whatever. But there are special consideration that must be given because of the nature of a child's testimony, and that a child's testimony ordinarily has to be carefully considered by the court. If it's younger children, their representatives, right, or the special assigned forensic social workers or other professional psychologists' reports, impact statements must be carefully considered by the court. So it carries quite a lot of weight. Right, the representatives of the child who then represents the child's testimony in court. It carries a lot of weight. What we have seen is there have been incidents where judgments have been made and then the public felt that the judge didn't fully consider the case. In cases like that, you can approach the court. Right, the child's representatives and stuff can approach the court either before a final judgment has been made or even after a judgment has been made. But there are avenues to approach the court and to bring, for example, and to identify the context. But the most important thing is you have to get those things in before a judgment made, because to undo judgments is a long process and a lengthy process. Right? Appeals take very, very long, and therefore it's very important. But the courts ordinarily is expected to give special care and special consideration to children's testimony.
Now, you know, in cases of this nature, especially if we look at this case where it happened at the restaurant, you know, the child had gone into the toilet with a child minder. The child minder had then left the child unsupervised. A question has come through, you know, on our WhatsApp line to ask, are parents or guardians held accountable when incidents of this nature take place in a public space, that they are negligent in terms of these minors that, you know, they are responsible for?
Yes, with the Child Care Act, you know, do provide sort of a framework to identify neglect, for example, and parental responsibility and stuff like that. Unfortunately, it's very, very difficult. For example, if you look at in the private home, for example, right, a parent can be busy with a child, and then the parent can even just leave the next room, or even in the same space, and the child can be violated. So it is a very difficult and complex situation when it comes to those kinds of stuff. Even at care centres, at a creche or a nursery, for example, the educator and the child minders can be in the same space, and that a child can be violated and abused, for example. Right. Yes. So it's very difficult, complex. But where the court might find that someone who ought to have known, or it was very clear to that person, and that person did not intervene or did not report or whatever, and where there's clear evidence to show neglect, for example, well, then charges could be brought against a child minder or even a parent for that matter.
All right. Well, Patrick, it's certainly been a very interesting conversation. Unfortunately, time does not permit for us to go on. But thank you so much for your insight and your time this morning. I'm sure our listeners as well have benefited from this conversation.
Yeah, and I think also from this case, we learned that it can happen anywhere. It can happen right under your nose. It can happen so quickly. And therefore, we need to keep an eye on children wherever they are, in home, in public spaces, next door, in front of the house, everywhere.
All right. Well, Patrick Solomon, thank you so much for your time. And that was Patrick Solomon from Molo Songololo there speaking to us in terms of the impact of a child witness in these court cases.